I'm Jenny Nevinson, and you are listening to the Minder Podcast.
Welcome to episode 42 of the Minder Podcast, in association with Minder.org. I am your host, Paul Stenning. If you are tuning in, then I like to think you might be glad to hear we are back and ready to talk all things Minder. I have had quite a few requests as to when the show was coming back. For some reason, some of you didn't know the situation and that I was taking a break. A break, that's amusing. I've been busier than ever and not even managed to do this show. However, as promised, I did keep in touch with Diana Mallin and spent a lot of time organising chats with her, but more of that later. For now, we are back and with a brand new episode. This one comes fairly timely to me, as I recently wrote an article on the subject, and I thought it fitting that as the person in question relates to a Minder episode, I should put together those connections for this first one back. So episode 42 is The Lady and the Minder. This relates to the final episode of Series 2, Caught in the Act Fact. Series 2, as I have mentioned before, is my favourite overall, and this was always an episode that intrigued me. It's certainly one of the more unusual episodes. It's more subtly amusing than straight out funny. In fact, it has a pretty dark overtone, as you will see. So we will cover the episode itself, and then in the second part, we will examine the real-life story which this episode relates to. I always like to see when searching an episode that the top search result is from Minder.org. Jonathan really does do a great job on all things Minder, so if you haven't already, then take yourself to the Fans of Minder website and look at all the great stuff on there. I am indebted to the site for some of the information here, especially when it comes to locations. So let's get going with episode 42. The Lady and the Minder. The writer of Caught in the Act Fact was Tony Hoare, and the director was Terry Green. A great partnership. A strange little fact is that Terry Green had worked on The Avengers, and Angela Brown, who stars as Lady Margaret in this Minder episode, appeared in two Avengers episodes, although they did not work together. One strange piece of trivia also regarding The Avengers. In Series 4 of Minder, the Carlot Baggers featured Christopher Benjamin and Artro Morris, Mr. Diath, or Mr. Death, as Arthur calls him. Both of these men were in the same Avengers episode as Angela Brown. Terry Green was one of the more prolific directors for Minder, being at the helm for 12 episodes altogether. The title of episode 13 of series 2, Caught in the Act Fact, was ironic in that Terry was caught doing absolutely nothing. Earlier in the episode he had driven a car used in a robbery, but he was blissfully unaware. The episode begins with Arthur's fish tank, not a line you will hear any other time. He is looking to offload goldfish, which he believes will be a gold mine. Terry thinks sharks are more his line. This sideline of goldfish goes throughout the episode courtesy of Stevie, played by Colin Proctor, who I interviewed in episode 33. As we go into the goldfish scene quite a bit there, I won't cover it so much in this episode. After showing Terry the goldfish and finding out that a hard case like Terry doesn't like anything that wriggles, except terrific birds of course, Arthur receives a call from an old pal called Harry Thompson. At first he has no idea what this is about, but through an accidental slip of the tongue, Arthur agrees to have a round, of golf that is. Harry mentions his golf club is the Melrose. In reality, this is the Richmond Golf Club in Surrey. I looked into the place a little and it's interesting indeed. The Richmond Golf Club, so they tell us on their website, was founded in February 1891. Being relatively close to Westminster, many of the club's original members were government ministers. These included three Lord Chancellors, a Speaker of the House of Commons, and a Prime Minister, Arthur Balfour. High office, they tell us, is no longer a requirement for membership, but the connection is maintained in various competition trophies, honouring illustrious past members. The course was originally laid out by prolific and esteemed course architect Tom Dunn in attractive parkland bordering Richmond Park and Ham Common. In recent years, the course has been substantially upgraded with the help of TPL, the firm of golf architects founded by 5 times Open champion Peter Thompson. Interesting synchronicity there, given Harry's surname is Thompson in the episode, though this is with a P. If you look at the Richmond Golf Club today, it still has the same look as in the episode, which makes a nice change. Some things actually never change. Back to the episode. Terry is waiting for Des to fix his car, and in the process becomes drawn into delivering a Cortina for a quick £25, and his car fix. Can't be bad for a drive, eh, Terry? There are some great lines from Des here. One I'd missed before being quite so striking was about someone Des knows who has met some rich pufter who's into rough trade and he's gone off. Then there is the classic line when Terry questions where he is picking up the motor. Don't be such a worry guts, it'll be there, says Des. When I interviewed George Layton, he didn't remember this line, but agreed it sounds like a northern saying. Not bad, Mr. Hoare. As Terry is waiting for the motor to be collected, he gets mildly confused by the sound of a police radio as he switches on what should be a regular car radio, and then, switching the station, listens to some immensely cheesy 70s-sounding muzak. He soon finds out that the Cortina was used in the robbery of mailbags from a security van which contained registered mail worth at least £10,000. That's about 45 grand today. As was often the case with Tony Hoare, he used a real-life story and incorporated it into a Minder episode. It's also just a hunch, but I think he might have meant this to be a bigger part of the story than it turned out to be. After all, it could have been perfect. That said, shooters were rarely used in Minder. To get the real-life story, we turn to the Worcester News. And wouldn't you believe this story occurred in January 1980, the same year of this Minder episode. Attempted Worcester Postal Sorting Office robbery in 1980. The Worcester News writes, "It was like something straight out of The Sweeney, the nation's favourite cops and robbers TV drama in the 70s. In the dead of a January night in 1980, an armed gang from Liverpool broke into Worcester's postal sorting office intent on robbery. But having been tipped off, the police were lying in wait and mayhem ensued. Mistaking a broom handle for a shotgun in the dark, a police marksman fired, a robber fell injured, and as his accomplices were rounded up, one of them quipped, 'Fair cop, I can hardly say I'm here to post a letter.' On the evening of Sunday, January 13th, 1980, John Badger, a postal worker for 19 years, clocked on the night shift at Worcester Sorting Office, expecting it to be much like any other. He was in for the shock of his life. At around 10:15 p.m, the doors suddenly burst open, and in charged 6 armed robbers wearing balaclavas. Within seconds, John was on the floor with a pistol pointed at his head. Then, from behind sorting tables, machinery and other assorted hiding places, emerged the police. A pitched battle ensued around the conveyor belts, bins and mailbags as pickaxe handles and iron bars were swung, blows were given and taken, and a gun was fired by a police marksman in an observation gallery, hitting one of the gang in the shoulder. John was later to say it was like Dodge City on a bad night. 4 of the 6 robbers were arrested inside the sorting office, where a safe contained more than £100,000 in cash and securities, while 2 managed to flee the building, crashing straight through a glass window and out into the road. So just to interject, in the Minder episode, they mention it was £10,000 of registered mail. This was £100,000. Perhaps it was seen as slightly more extravagant. 2 managed to flee the building, crashing straight through a glass window and out into the road. One who had broken his ankle was found shortly after by a police dog, which tracked his scent to the nearby Midland Red depot and onto a parked bus. The man must have realised it was not his night, as he tried to hide under the vehicle's back row of seats, with a hairy Alsatian barking at him close up and personal. The 6th member of the gang disappeared, and although 2 years later, police arrested 26-year-old David Hughes, when he came before Hereford Crown Court, a jury found him not guilty. Trial of the other 5 defendants, which began at Worcester Crown Court in February 1981, involved one of the biggest security operations ever mounted by police in the Midlands. The case was later transferred to Birmingham Crown Court, where the gang all pleaded guilty to aggravated burglary and received jail terms totalling 50 years. So this was a big deal at the time, and of course especially in Worcester. And given we are talking about Lady Barnet, as you will find out, who was based in Leicester, it's perhaps no coincidence that Worcester is not all that far away. Seems to me like Tony Hall was at least spending some time in and around the Midlands, and may have picked up local news stories that way. When Arthur meets up with his friend Harry, aside from the very amusing scenes of him trying to play golf to Harry's standard, he finds out why he's been contacted. Incidentally, the golf course is notoriously difficult. As the golf club website states, at 6,100 yards, the course is not long, yet it presents a stiff challenge to golfers of all abilities. Narrow tree-lined fairways and strategically placed bunkers put a premium on accuracy. Very few amateur golfers match their handicap when they visit. Even professional players find the going tough here. So there you go. That's why Arthur can't play the course very well and has to throw the ball out of the bunker.
What's your handicap?
There's nothing wrong with me, Harry. I'm in fine shape, I tell you.
Your golf handicap, Alan.
Oh, golf handicap. Oh, yeah, but same as yours, Harry.
Right, off you go.
Oops. Well, there's something wrong with the tee, I think, Harry. It's not flat. Oh, there we are. It is a dog leg, the first, Harry, yes?
No, Arthur, it's straight up the middle.
Harry's wife, Lady Margaret Thompson, sits as a magistrate and has done for 2 years. Arthur mentions he had recently seen she had been merciful to some misguided wrongdoer, and Harry states she is a wonderfully warm human being. We are not privy to some of their conversation, so that we are left completely in the dark along with Terry as to the future actions of Lady Margaret. We hear a clue that part of the minding might be to do with someone taking revenge against the instrument of justice who sent them there, as Arthur says. He finishes with, "It's certainly a problem, Harry, but of course it's just eccentricity." This is a very interesting comment because it connects with something that is often shown in many fictional portrayals of the aristocracy, namely that they are eccentric. As if someone without money and status cannot be eccentric, or indeed that just because you are an aristocrat you must be eccentric. Some people are mad, not just eccentric, but madness comes in all forms and is not limited to those with status. Tony Hall's line reminds us that it's often how those with money and status are viewed. It's part of what gives people the mindset that they, those crazy privileged few, can do what they like. The normal protocols of society do not apply to them, you see. When Arthur is explaining about his friend Harry to Terry, he mentions that he is in the building trade and married into the aristocracy. It's interesting to imagine someone in the building trade marrying to wealth and status, but it's worth noting that a man marrying a lady does not automatically become a sir or acquire a noble title. In reverse, i.e. a woman marrying a sir, a title is inherited, but more of that later. Was this a deliberate slip from Tony Hall, or was he simply unaware of how the aristocracy works? I suppose technically he has married into the aristocracy, but the inference is that now he is part of it. There are a couple of interesting things heard on the radio as Terry hears of the security van raid. Firstly, the name of Dickie Arbiter is mentioned. He did indeed work on London radio, but would also become a commentator on the Royal Family. Some synchronicity there. Even his daughter Victoria is linked to the Royals. Dickie Arbiter, by the way, is still alive and going strong at 88. I couldn't resist contacting him and asking him about his lines in Minder and whether he remembered them. After a few emails and me sending him the episode, he wrote, "Hi Paul, my wife and I have listened to the clip several times and concluded that despite the name check, the voice was too posh. But then it was 46 years ago and I was 46 years younger, so it may well have been me. But as mentioned last week, I have absolutely no recollection. Sorry. Have a good week. Best, Dickie. Well, thanks, Dickie, and we wish you the best. I think it was perhaps a pre-recorded piece, unless there really was a mailbag raid and it was the real news. But then, knowing Minder, there would often be different voices for a character, played by Lord knows who. So perhaps, as Dickie was very well known at the time, it was a ringer pretending to be him. Missing royalty somewhere, perhaps. I do personally think it probably was him, and he just can't remember. Secondly, on the radio, we hear that the robbery occurred on Vickers Road. There is a Vickers Road which comes under Bexley Heath. Was there a reason Tony Hoare included this road, which was quite some distance from West London? I think there must be, but cannot find anything interesting. There is a Vicar Road in Worcester. Terry is taken into police custody for his role in driving the Cortina. He is told his prints are on the vehicle, although it later transpires they are only on the outside, and anyone can put their prints on the outside of a car. Terry is locked up for 2 days before being released without charge, and we have the well-to-do Mr. Knight, who must be paid his 100 guineas for his services, which Terry persuades Des to pay. Given the currency of the guinea was taken out of use in 1971, it's rather an outdated term, which is yet another Tony Hoare dig at those involved in the privileged professions. When Terry is brought in to mind Lady Margaret, he is told that he just has to accompany her shopping and do the odd jobs. Easy money as usual. Before he even meets her, however, he makes a sharp remark about the upper classes. Born into money and privilege, and it is the likes of Arthur who put them there, he says, living off the likes of him. So he is rather surprised, along with Arthur, when her ladyship opens the door, looking rather scruffy, and begins talking about gas cylinders while wearing welding goggles. Cracking line about the bleeding daisy she is wearing, which refers to boots. Daisy roots. Lady Margaret is into questionable art. In fact, her sculptures are terrible, eccentric or not. What is interesting in the exchanges about her art are some of her comments, such as when she says that sculpting is a way to relax, as she gets very tense at times. She relates to Terry hitting things in the gym as a way of releasing that tension, which surprises him as something he had obviously not really thought about before. And given how down to earth he is, Lady Margaret immediately takes to him, thinking of Arthur more like a butler and a very old-fashioned character. Instead of the bowing and addressing her as Mom, as Arthur is wont to do, Terry can call her Maggie.
It's all right, isn't it?
Well, it's not finished yet.
But you're going to colour it in like that?
Oh, maybe.
Do you sell them or anything?
Well, a few friends are kind enough to buy a few pieces. Harry wants to set up an exhibition for me, but I don't think I'm good enough for that. Yeah, I do it for relaxation, mainly. What do you do to relax?
I hit people.
What, really?
Well, I go down the gym, I work out a bit.
Yeah. Get rid of the tensions?
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah.
Yes. I get very tense at times.
Don't we all?
Have you always done this sort of thing? Looking after people?
Well, mostly, yeah. It's all I can do, really.
What's your relationship with Mr. Daly?
Oh, he's just a mate. Well, he gets me a few jobs now and again.
Funny chap. Like a character from the 50s, almost.
Yeah. No, I suppose he does live in the past a bit. No, it's all right, we get on well.
Like the Odd Couple?
Oh, I don't know about that.
Look, if you're bored and you like exercise, my dog could do with a daily constitutional.
Well, of course, yeah, if you want me to, Lady Johnson, yeah.
Maggie?
Pardon?
Call me Maggie.
No, I couldn't do that.
Oh, please. To tell the truth, I got awfully bored with this sort of ladyship stuff.
Well, all right then, Maggie. Arthur's gonna love that.
The real Thompson House is at 43 Lansdowne Crescent, West 11, and this certainly was posh. This semi-detached house today is ranked as the most expensive property in West 11, with a valuation of £14,115,000. So you might say it's retained its value and then some. It last sold for £10 million in 2010. Travelling from here to Ledbury Road, incidentally, is just half a mile away. You might remember Ledbury Road was used for Whose Wife Is It Anyway, also from Series 2. Certainly for Series 2, it seemed that when a posh location was required, Notting Hill seemed the perfect setting. One day, Terry takes Lady Margaret shopping to Whiteley's, which makes sense as it's just a 10-minute drive from her house and was a fairly well-to-do department store at the time, similar to Harrods, which is also mentioned in the episode. In fact, it was known as the Harrods of the 19th century. It was also akin to Selfridges and was indeed taken over by Harry Selfridge in the 20s. Surely this was not a reference to the Harry Thompson in the episode. Maybe a bit of a stretch. Harry Selfridge later did sell the store though, and it being shown in Minder is something for posterity as it closed down just a year after filming. It took many years before it was demolished and rebuilt. Today though, it is likely to be turned into apartments. After accompanying Maggie to Whiteley's, Terry loses her and walks out of the store carrying a bag full of goods from the store. He is immediately accosted by security, who accuse him of stealing the items. Cue a return to the station to be met by total dismissal from Chisholm, who believes this time Terry really is bang to rights. Who would believe Terry over a highly respected citizen as Lady Margaret Thompson, a magistrate no less? She has never heard of you, he tells Terry, and neither has her husband. The security man mentions how he has been in this business a long time and is rarely wrong. Rarely? That's okay then. Here follows further comments upon the us and them of society. No one could possibly believe a societal reject like Terry McCann could possibly be working for Lady Margaret, much less that he was innocently holding her bag and thought she had left the store. We are shown Lady Margaret staring blankly into space, back in her own house, seemingly oblivious to everything. She is said to have had a nervous breakdown and is taken into a nursing home, or private sanatorium, by the doctor, which seems a strange remedy, and one which Harry is okay with. Arthur acts defiantly at Terry's story, making out Terry has had a mental aberration, which must be due to a knock on the head. As for Lady Margaret, Harry explains she doesn't know she's doing it, or at least won't acknowledge it. Even Harry isn't sure. What he is sure of is that Arthur should have given Terry the full SP on her predilections. We then get a rare moment of personal liability from Arthur. He says, perhaps, just perhaps, I have made a slight tactical error. This then leads to the confusing act of trying to get Terry out of shtuck without actually acknowledging the truth. All along, Arthur protects the good name of his friend Harry. Stevie returns to the Winchester after a right-hander over being given brand new clothing in return for goldfish. The fish are mentioned again at the end of the episode when Arthur tries to appease Terry and mention the future work connected to his great business plan involving goldfish. He makes sure to stand up to Chisholm without giving anything away, telling him it is a gross breach of human rights and a diabolical abuse of police power. This is very fitting given the real story behind this episode, as is the comment that Lady Margaret is well known for her acts of charity. I'm being fitted up here, Terry tells Arthur. Chisholm shows his ruthlessness, acknowledging that Terry may well be innocent, but tells him, frankly, I don't care, because you are well overdue for a warning. An interesting note about the police in this episode is that the very first appearance of DC Jones was made by Ken Sharrock. Yes, Jones, who would be played for 21 episodes by Mike Povey. Minder was actually Ken Sharrock's very first role on TV, and as you know, this was the last episode of Series 2. But when Series 3 of Minder began, it was Mike Povey who was DC Jones and not Ken Sharrock. It was an interesting change to the character of Jones. With Ken Sharrock, we had a slightly more serious officer who Chisholm seemed to listen to and work with more on a par. When Mike Povey came in, he was of course more of a sidekick who Chisholm liked to override or belittle. After Minder, Ken Sharrock would still be a familiar presence on TV in the 80s and was especially known for Brookside. Rest in peace, Ken, who passed away at just 56 in 2003. When up in court, Arthur reveals he lives at 18 Arcadia Avenue, the upmarket end of West 14. There is no Arcadia Avenue in real life in West 14, although there is one in what looks like a quite industrial part of Finchley in North London. Arthur also mentions he has connections in the world of show business. Now, this may be just a typical case of Arthur exaggerating his connections, but when said to a judge, I would say it probably refers to the fact that the real life story was linked to show business, as there was no real reason for him to say it. Arthur refers to the judge's lordship, but is told your worship is the correct form. Arthur calls Terry one of life's spiritual orphans and reveals he has managed to keep him under his protective wing, with a nice show of this protection with his right arm. Terry is given a somewhat lenient sentence given he admitted stealing to avoid any further problems. 6 months in prison, suspended for 2 years. He is not impressed by Arthur's character reference in the dock and is not thankful at all, walking away from everyone, perhaps a little ungratefully given both Des and Dave turned up to support him. It is to be remembered that this episode was shown as the last in the series, so not only does that give it some extra importance, but there was some time before the reappearance of Minder on TV screens. It would indeed seem that the viewer was left in the dark for some time. Would Terry forgive Arthur?
As you have kept out of trouble for some time, it will be suspended for 2 years, that is to say. If you commit any offence within the next 2 years, you will almost certainly have to serve this sentence of 6 months. So go away and keep out of trouble.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chisholm.
What did I tell you? Suspended sentence, not even a fine. That's as good as getting slung, Terry. I told you could
rely on... Don't say another word, all right? Or I'm liable to forget how you saved me from myself all these years.
Terry, how could you? After all I said in there on your behalf... Look, you owe your freedom to me, make no mistake about that. You saw his worship. Impressed?
Impressed? It was bleeding humiliating. Who'd you think you were in there, Hamlet?
Well, I thought Arthur spoke up very well. He did you a right turn.
Gave him a right turn, more like.
Now, listen, you two. I've got a conviction for theft down to you, right? So if you think I'm going to be grateful for any help you may have given me, forget it. And as for you, in the future, leave me alone.
Now, Terry, look, just forget about it. It's all over. What we've got to think about now is getting you a bit of work. I didn't tell you about my scheme for the goldfish, did I? It was Stevie Taylor had a go at it, but he was no good. He's the wrong type, you know what I mean?
Terry!
Tony Hall was one of the most astute writers in television. He did not just sit pondering for plots and use sheer imagination for his storylines. As we have covered on previous episodes, Tony instead used things he knew about intimately or interesting stories which were being covered in news. In the case of Caught in the Act Fact, he used a story which did not initially make the national press. At first it was restricted to those in the know in the Leicester area. How he knew of this depends on when you believe this story was submitted, but more of that shortly. In Leicestershire, in the village of Cossington, lived Lady Isabel Barnett, a former television show panellist and radio veteran. As she had turned into her 50s, life had not been as kind to her as the preceding years. Her heavy smoking and predilection for a nice drink had started to catch up with her, and she had numerous symptoms, not least of which was a throat issue which required an operation, as well as painful arthritis. A recent car accident had not helped at all. While Lady Barnett was reasonably well off given her showbiz career and the money left by her deceased husband, she had for some reason, so the rumours said, started to steal the odd item from the local shop. Her husband, local solicitor Geoffrey Barnett, was 13 years older than Isabel, and he passed away in 1970. Although she put on a brave face, the loss affected her greatly. And so, if she did steal, it was not for the lack of money to buy items, but rather a more complicated series of mental reasons that she did not seek help for. The stealing was just a rumour, of course, and the locals also believed she had a drink problem. But there was not exactly proof. Until one day in early 1980, she was caught by the local shopkeeper putting a tin of tuna and a carton of cream in her coat pocket, known as a poacher's pocket. Lady Barnett said she intended to pay for the items, but the shopkeeper, Roger Fowkes, was not convinced and reported her to the police. Unbelievably, given her standing in the area and formidable charity record, the police took this seriously, and Lady Barnett was sent to answer for the charges in court before her birthday in June 1980. That year she would turn 62. Although there is much more to this story, this podcast is not the place to tell you everything concerning the Lady Barnett mystery. And it is a mystery, a fabulously intriguing one. For more on this story, you can read the full article at my website under Current Writing. That's ghostwriterandauthor.com, and look for Current Writing. There is a shorter version available also at the Leicester Gazette. Both of these come up on Google when you search Lady Barnet. What we shall do here is cover the similarities with the Minder episode and point out how the dates were so tight in terms of what happened after filming that it's possibly a surprise the episode was even released. It is very clear that Lady Margaret Thompson was based on Lady Isabel Barnet. She lives in a white house for one thing, and Lady Barnet's house was called the White House. The age and appearance is quite similar, although at this stage in life, Lady Barnet was actually 20 years older than Angela Brown. She died in 2001, not long after what would have been Lady Barnet's 83rd birthday. Angela Brown was only 63, but died of natural causes. Coincidentally, Lady Barnet was 62 when she died. One reason Angela Brown was cast is she had played the role of a lady in several previous productions, so carried it well. But like Lady Barnet, she was also very down-to-earth and likeable. And like her, Angela Brown also carried out charity work in her later years. They even had a very similar tone of voice. I believe Glyn Houston was based on Sir Geoffrey Barnet. Think about it. He would have made a better solicitor than a builder, wouldn't he? Welsh actor Houston lived until he was 93 and had played a huge variety of roles in film, television and theatre long before he appeared in Minder. In real life, it was Geoffrey Barnet who had been made a sir, and by default, Isabel Barnet became a lady. She was not at all a member of the aristocracy. Yet the stern, almost severe role of Harry Thompson was a fair representation of Geoffrey Barnet. Tony Hoare had to find a way to work in the mental aberration of Lady Margaret and used Harry as the guardian who was trying to protect her, although in real life, there was no one who protected Lady Isabel. We are told that Lady Margaret sits as a magistrate, and there is an immediate connection as well as confusion. Lady Barnet sat as a justice of the peace, which is essentially the same as a magistrate. But it's important to note that they do not need formal legal training. They are voluntary positions, only given to people with good standing in the community. Lady Barnet certainly had this, and was very well respected, something referred to in Minder for Lady Margaret. We do not get to hear her career background. It is inferred that she works only in the legal profession, with her sculpting as a hobby. Lady Barnet had a career background as a doctor, though spent the majority of her career as a television and radio personality once she was discovered. Tony Hoare includes the temptation to steal items from what seemed like a routine shopping trip. It is never completely revealed, but merely inferred that the bag Terry is carrying is Lady Margaret's and she has just wandered off. So perhaps she had no intention of stealing, sounds familiar. Like Lady Barnet, living in luxury with plenty of income, Lady Margaret had no reason to steal. It was a mental condition which was not quite fully understood. In Minder, typical of the us versus them mentality of the working classes being stifled, Terry has to take the blame for a theft he did not commit. But in real life, Lady Isabel had to take responsibility herself for what happened, even though she, like Terry, argued her case that she had no intention to steal. She was adamant, which can only mean one of two things. Either she was telling the truth, or she had a mental illness which she did not understand herself. As Harry tells Arthur, it's a sickness with her. Tony Hoare was not to know just how meaningful this line would become with what happened next to Lady Barnet. In the Minder episode, it is a strange cliffhanger where we never know what became of Lady Margaret. She is, as we said earlier, said to have had a nervous breakdown and taken into a nursing home or private sanatorium, which does seem odd, as we said before. As we also mentioned, sculpting, she had told Terry, was a way to relax as she got very tense at times. This is another hint that all is not well with her, although it's a fairly subtle clue. Lastly, as mentioned earlier, we have the reference to show business made by Arthur in court. It can, in my view, only refer to Lady Barnet, but again, it was quite subtle and most people would miss it. In fact, I'm not sure anyone watching this episode, even in real time, would have thought about the Lady Barnet story, even after she had passed away. All in all, Caught in the Act Fact is one of the most remarkable Minder episodes. There is a lot going on, and it's a fair representation of the best the show had to offer. We also have the immortal line from Terry, which I couldn't help but use in the Top 10 Birds episode. Typical Minder, the ability to go from something ridiculous to serious in just a few seconds. The ever-present humour is littered throughout. characters who appear as if they are regulars when they were actually there for just one episode. An amazing feat of writing, acting and directing. I do have the feeling this was two episodes placed into one, but have no evidence whatsoever for this. The only suggestive evidence is the dates of writing would have had to match the news piece on Lady Barnett, which would mean handing in a script in late June at the earliest. My feeling is there was an unintentionally heartless use of the court case instead, and this was inserted right at the end of the episode. Indeed, we don't actually have the scenes between Terry and Lady Margaret until more than halfway through. According to Minder.org, this episode was filmed in either August or September of 1980. However, it should be pointed out that even according to those dates, It's All About Scoring in It was filmed after Caught in the Act, even though that was shown earlier on TV. Scoring was actually filmed in October. The idea of Caught in the Act being filmed in September would only tally with this story if Tony Hall already knew what had been going on with a former show business personality in the small village of Cossington. With his network, you never know. As we have seen, the similarities are so specific that it is simply impossible for this story to be unrelated. Perhaps if this were a different writer, I would say otherwise, but I have proven several times that Tony Hall very much took real news events and turned them into plots. It is simply unthinkable that he did not use the information about the real lady we have spoken about. Therefore, there are only three possibilities. Either the filming was done slightly later than other evidence shows, or the plot was changed and some filming was done later. I lean towards this being the case. I think the meeting a well-to-do friend at the golf club, the goldfish scenes, and the Cortina scenes with Terry could have all been an existing episode. Perhaps the inclusion of a lady in the scenes with Angela Brown, not to mention the ending, were added in when a particular news story broke. After all, Terry had actually been caught previously in the episode, so even the title might already have existed. It is also provable that some scripts were delivered just a month before filming, and that transmissions followed a few months later, so time-wise it can just about be fitted in. The last possible theory is that there was some kind of inside knowledge as to what was going on with the real Lady Barnett. Though this is a remote chance, I would not actually be that surprised if Tony knew people who knew something, and this may have even been a setup. In Minder, Terry is set up. In real life, it could well have been the lady. Don't forget, Tony Hoare also knew the Worcester news story about the post office. And as I said, it's not too far away from Leicester. The real life setup that I mentioned, well, I won't go into that too much for this episode. But if you're interested in more about the subject, you can read my full article and you'll see what I mean. The Minder episode predated Lady Barnett's life, which ended on the 20th of October 1980 due to an apparent suicide. But as you will see if you read my article, this is where the mystery really begins. I hope Lady Barnett rests in peace. Now, as promised, an update on Diana Mallin. I mentioned previously that we had been in touch and there had been a bit of back and forth, so to speak. Well, since then we got into much more communication, and despite several false starts, we got to speak in December a few times, which this time was actually recorded for posterity and followed a somewhat normal interview style. I say somewhat, as it was a much more down-to-earth chat than some, even for me, and there were some gaps in the memory, which of course is always to be expected. I wanted to put the Lady Barnett episode out first, as it links with the piece I recently wrote on the 45th anniversary of her death, which was October 2025. But the next episode will certainly be the interview with Diana Mallin. We're looking to get the brand new website up and running, hopefully to coincide with this episode, but if not, then it will follow afterwards, perhaps in March. In the meantime, if you want to write to me, then please do so at info@ghostwriterandauthor.com. That's info@ghostwriterandauthor.com. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode, and if you have any further information on this, or indeed Lady Barnett. Until next time, thanks for listening.
She's a terrific bird.